This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by HP Print Studio. Express your brand with HP Print Studio. Find free, customized templates to build your business identity, like letterhead, business cards, and shipping labels. Start the journey at www.hp.ca/print.
Hello, I'm Stuart McLean, and this is The Vinyl Cafe. The first time I ever heard negative political advertising was in California in the late 1970s. I was there covering the California congressional elections and, on the side, working up a story on the remarkable possibility that the ex-governor of California and B-movie actor Ronald Reagan might secure the Republican nomination to run for president, something we all found hard to believe at the time. The ads were about a proposition of some sort, actually a couple of propositions, which are plebiscites or referendums that were and still are included regularly on the California state ballot. I remember the first ad I heard as clear as day. It was stunning to my innocent, or maybe I should say naive, Canadian ears. It was a radio jingle sung by a barbershop quartet, decrying what the ad claimed were stupid laws. When you hear it today, that ad sounds incredibly tame. But believe me, when it came over my car radio in 1979, it was, as far as I was concerned, the most staggering piece of political business I'd ever heard.
In the good old summertime, in the
Hey,
good
Mario!
Old
Clancy, wait till we finished. You'll get your haircut.
Mario, I'm not here for a haircut. I'm here to arrest you.
Arrest?
Arrest!
Arrest!
You're smoking, aren't you?
Sure, it's my barber shop.
Nobody smokes.
Clancy, that's stupid.
Stupid!
Stupid!
Stupid! Well, you could put in a smoker's section.
A smoker's section in a one-man barbershop? Really stupid, Clancy.
Stupid!
Stupid!
Never mind that. I don't make the laws, Mario.
Stupid laws are breaking up that old quartet of ours.
What California does not need is another stupid law dictating conduct that is best governed by common sense. Join Californians for Common Sense who paid for this announcement to bring you this moment of sanity.
Vote no on Proposition 5.
Now I admit that's funny, and maybe even clever. But when I heard it that afternoon so long ago, that ad also struck me as being appallingly rude, and at its core, vacuous. It sought to insult rather than to inform, and was, in my opinion anyway, not helpful in any way. I wasn't used to that sort of public discourse. "You'd never hear that kind of thing in Canada," I told people I spoke to that week. I didn't say that as much smugly as I did earnestly. And in a way, I was right. You wouldn't have heard that sort of thing in Canada in those days. Those were the days when you could still hear the echoes of men like Tommy Douglas, John Diefenbaker, and Lester Pearson in the halls of Parliament. Men who spoke with passion, certainly, but with a kind of passion that reverberated in the world of ideas. Men who, I feel safe saying, would have been as taken back as I was by the tone of that ad. In a way, I was right. But in a way, I was wrong. What I didn't understand at the time was that you didn't hear those sort of ads in the United States in those days either. The ads being produced in that California campaign signaled a revolution in political advertising. "Get used to it," my American political friends predicted. "It's here to stay." My friends had recognized something that I hadn't grasped. They knew that when things work in California, they tend to have a viral nature, and viruses spread. Rather than the aberration I took them for, those campaigns that I covered some 25 years ago turned out to be in the vanguard of negative political advertising. By the time the century ended, negative advertising in politics was not only pervasive, it had mutated into an uglier and more pernicious thing. The attack ad. Now, I bring this up today because something remarkable in negative political advertising happened in Canada a few weeks ago. Something that's never happened before, as far as I know. And I think, like those ads I heard in California 25 years ago, it marks a turning point, and as such, should be remarked on. Here's the background. A few weeks ago, the Liberal Party of Canada, led by the leader of the opposition, Stéphane Dion, released a proposal for implementing a carbon tax in Canada. I think most of us can agree that the issue of burning fossil fuel and the implications that has for climate change may be the most important issue of public policy in our lifetime. While Mr. Dion, the leader of the opposition, is proposing a carbon tax to address the issue, the governing Conservatives believe in implementing a system of caps. The Greens, who favor the carbon tax, and the New Democratic Party, who have proposed a cap-and-trade policy, have also weighed in. Now, I don't know which of these ideas is better. The Liberals are suggesting the way to cut back on carbon emissions is to use taxation to make carbon more expensive. They believe if fossil fuel costs more, we will be more restrained in the way we use it. The Conservatives believe it would be better to legislate actual limits, to set caps on how much carbon emissions industry can release. All three proposals, the carbon tax, the cap and trade, and the cap, are presumably valid proposals. And I'm hoping to hear some serious debate to help me make up my mind about which might be better and who might be more committed to implementing change. So far, I'm out of luck. In an unprecedented step, the Conservative Party responded to Mr. Dion's proposal by releasing a series of attack ads. Actually, the ads were released before the proposal in a preemptive attempt to control the debate. Now, attack ads are certainly not new to this country, from either party. I say unprecedented because ads like these have, dare I say, traditionally being aired during the 35 days of an official election campaign, that is, after the writ has dropped and the election has begun, at a time when we're used to having the heat of the political stove turned up. The ads, in my opinion anyway, are a disgrace and do not contribute to the public discourse in any imaginable way. They are mean-spirited and they're low, and they make that little Californian jingle look like a walk in the park. In case you haven't heard them, I'm going to play one for you right now.
We got Sue on the line talking about Stéphane Dion's carbon tax. Sue.
Well, we got another politician here with another trick up his sleeve, don't we?
The Dion tax trick?
Yeah, he's been going around the country making billions of dollars in spending promises. This tax is the only way he's going to be able to pay for it all. I'm telling you, it's here to stay.
You got that right. First he was against it, now he's wrapped it up in this new phony green package.
Yeah, give me a break.
Well put. The Dion tax trick. Everybody sees through it.
Authorized by the registered agent of the Conservative Party of Canada.
So, Mr. Dion's environmental proposal and its merits or demerits have been completely ignored in that ad. His policy initiative, worthy of serious discussion, whatever you think of it, has been redefined as a tax trick, the Dion tax trick. The Prime Minister himself went even further. He descended into vulgarity and said Mr. Dion's ideas would screw everyone. Lest I be accused of partisanship here, I hasten to add that the Conservatives are not the only ones who have played this game. The Liberal Party were happy to indulge in their own fear-mongering during the last few election campaigns. They had an ad on their website that tried to make the case that if the Conservatives were elected, they might deploy armed soldiers on the streets of Canada. They also tried to paint Mr. Harper as a dangerous social conservative who would place in jeopardy a woman's right to choose. So why am I so upset, you might wonder? Why should I be so surprised? Because I happen to believe that when politicians descend to this level, it is to the danger of us all. For it's not only disrespectful of each other, it's also disrespectful to the system by which we govern ourselves. And it's a system that has worked well. The system is elegantly simple. We have a government, and we have an alternative government. And our ability to choose between them, and therefore to make the system work, relies on civility and public discourse. And that is far removed from these ads that are running now and similar ads that have run at other times. The ads should be withdrawn, and the vulgar talk about screwing people should stop. It is alienating language, and it's alienating behavior, and it's no surprise when it breeds an alienated turnout at the polls. A few weeks ago, our Prime Minister stood up in the House of Commons and displayed he was capable of greatness. His moving apology to the people of the First Nations for the cultural devastation that was wrought by residential schools brought tears to my eyes. He made me weep. He would do well to reconnect with the place that came from and use it as his moral compass when he's asked to approve television and radio ad campaigns. In politics, as in everything, the process is as important as the product. You cannot kill your way to peace or lie your way to justice. The way you walk it is the way it is. Mr. Dion has called for a debate on his proposals. Mr. Harper has a choice. He can choose to ape those California advertising men who I stumbled upon in the 1970s and drag us all into the political gutter, or he can look to the states again, at the possibility of the political discourse that may be emerging in their upcoming presidential election, the grand debate over policy that Mr. McCain and Mr. Obama both seem to want to conduct. They might be on the precipice of a great leap in America, a leap backwards to more dignified and thoughtful times. It would be nice if we could join in, or at least keep the pace. This is Aaron Booth with his song, "The Many Lead the One."
Fair weather nation, what have we done? What do we live and die for? What battle overcome? It's deep inside the struggle of people in distant lands is a song a million voices strong, the music of a marching band. Songs to be sung, songs to be sung, voices to to the air, the many lead the one. but have we what we need? There's some things worth fighting for. A language we all understand. In a song, a million voices strong. Marching band. Songs to be sung. Songs to be sung. Voices taking to the air. The many lead the one. Voices taking to the air.
That was Aaron Booth from Calgary, Alberta, with a song called The Many Lead the One. And some of you might remember we played the demo version of that song a few years ago. Well, Aaron re-recorded, and it's on his latest album called Backstories. We're kind of on a political tear today on the Vinyl Cafe, just the right kind of tear to be on, given the political holidays we're celebrating this week on both sides of the 49th parallel. You might remember the last time we talked politics was through a correspondence that I conducted with an American judge, Mike Van Epps, a fan of the show who I stumbled upon ice fishing last winter on Lake Simcoe. I have another letter from him today. Dear Stewart, he writes, well, you're certainly full of surprises, aren't you? As if suddenly appearing at my ice hut door and then opening your Keswick concert with a story about the encounter wasn't enough. Bang! 2 weeks later, you're back at it, not simply reading my letter on air, but responding to it, too. And now you've gone and given me the toughest writing assignment I've encountered since my undergraduate days at the University of Michigan. What is it, you've asked me, that I love about my own nation, that elephant slumbering ever so fitfully to the south of your mouse? I can't help thinking you've chosen the wrong guy. I think I mentioned on Lake Simcoe that I'm dispirited by my current government. I find myself sharing the attitude of many people from other nations who I've heard say, oh, we love Americans, it's their government we can't stand. The compulsion of my country to impose its interests on the rest of the world seems to have been building momentum of late, and I grow more and more ashamed. Nevertheless, I've been mulling your question since you posed it. Thus far, I've broken things down into two categories, the tangible and the intangible. The first tangible element which comes to my mind would be our Constitution, the document so cunningly drafted as to be both specific enough and vague enough to have survived as the foundation for this remarkable experiment in governance for more than two centuries. My country made a brief and abortive attempt at confederation following our revolution. It soon became evident that the individualism, which you've correctly identified as the genesis of the American spirit, made us particularly unsuited for the collective ideal, which is the essential medium for the survival of a confederation. We're a nation of people all striving for their individual success. In order to maintain a government able to withstand the predictable disputes and disagreements, our founding fathers correctly determined that a federal form of government was required, with a strong executive branch. The document establishing the remarkable balance between the branches of the executive and between local and national governments remains a singularly praiseworthy accomplishment. That the document has remained in full force and effect for so long, and with so very few alterations, stands as a monument to the wisdom and creativity of those who gathered in Philadelphia in 1783 to draft it. In the intangible column, I place my countrymen. I think that you touched on this element in your letter to me, describing an independence and can-do spirit that's often credited for America's success. My country has been the source of a startling array of inventions and innovations during the last century. It seems that nearly every advance in this period has had a brush with American ingenuity. If not actually invented by Americans, so many developments were adapted by Americans, who created markets for the new technologies which went on to become essential elements of modern life. Americans may not have invented the moving picture, the railroad, or the telephone, but we sure as heck were able to embrace them, refine them, and make a big whack of money from them. There clearly is an aspect of American culture that's alluring to other people across the world. I personally find it more than a little disheartening to see the spread of the metaphoric golden arches to every corner of the world. I'm not sure what the allure is. I wonder, however, if it might be an attraction to that amorphous willingness of Americans to take the risk, to make the leap, which captures the world's imagination. I think that the American spirit may touch on the universal human condition of desire for improvement, improvement of oneself, of one's economic and social position, of the opportunities available for one's children and grandchildren. I think I've gone on far too long, yet there's much more to say. Until we touch base again, I'd like to thank you for your work in general and for stopping by my ice hut in particular. I'd like to hear from you one time about what you think distinguishes our countries one from the other. Sincerely, your ice fishing pal, Mike Van Epps. Mike Van Epps wrote from Michigan. It's my turn now. Dear Mike, I've been thinking about your letter these past few days and your eloquent description of those things that you love about your country, and it's got me thinking about mine. You asked me how I thought our countries were different. I'm going to try and answer that. You are right about the pervasive tidal wave of American commercial culture. That tide's probably higher here at the edge of the beach than it is anywhere else in the world. We're privy to your television shows, your movies, and your music, and knee-deep in all the other flotsam and jetsam of corporate America. Not that anyone's complaining. We seem to like it. And given that, it's completely understandable why an American finding herself in a Canadian town or city might look around and decide that very little, if anything, distinguishes us one from another. We certainly look the same, golden arches and all. And at the very heart of it, there is much that binds us together. But like all hearts that are drawn together, there are things that separate us one from each other. More, for sure, than meets the eye. If we wanted to chronicle them, these defining differences, we could do worse than begin our chronicles, where one should always begin a story. And that, of course, would be at the beginning. In 1776, when the urge for independence stirred the imaginations and pocketbooks of your forefathers, they rose up against the British crown and took on what was arguably the strongest military force that had ever been established. I can't think of another former colony which actually succeeded in winning its independence from Great Britain through the force of arms. Canada, for instance, waited for an invitation to set off on her own, which wasn't an altogether bad idea. By waiting, we did help in the formation of that oddly anachronistic, yet surprisingly worthwhile international gathering of former colonies known as the Commonwealth. It would be tempting, however, given the tenor of these times, to read a meaning into these two distinctly different births. The warrior and the what? The peacemaker? True or not, that's the way we like to think of it. There's plenty of corroborating evidence. We have both, for instance, since we achieved our independence, been confronted with a threat to our nationhood when a faction of one of our societies has attempted to take its leave from the whole. Twice in my life, the predominantly French-speaking province of Quebec has turned to the ballot box and tried, through referendum, to sever itself from the Canadian body politic and achieve some sort of distinct nation status. Canada came within a whisker of disassembling or reassembling or whatever you want to call it. And once again, not a drop of blood was spilled. Your nation faced the same civil crisis about 100 years earlier. And once again, it was resolved by years of violent confrontation, nary a ballot box in sight. What does that say about us Canadians, I mean? Do we feel things less deeply than you? Are we cowards? Wimps? Do we have a different genetic code? We certainly have a different national anthem. Oh, I could go on forever comparing our national anthems. Yours is full of bombs bursting and the red glare of rockets. Ours? Well, it's hard to say anything for certain about ours. To begin with, there are three official versions, each with completely different lyrics. One is in Inuktitut, one is in French, and one is in English. And each one is completely different, and I can't even talk with complete certainty about the English one. A few years ago, our parliamentarians actually changed the lyrics to the English version because it was felt, well, it was felt that the anthem asked us to stand on guard for Canada a few times too often. It was felt to be too assertive. No one's exactly sure what the new words are. Well, someone is. Maybe a lot of people are, but a lot of us aren't. So when we're called upon to sing our national anthem, we Canadians tend to start strong and then peter out. We all keep meaning to learn the new words, and the French verse, for that matter, but we never actually do, and so you can only assume we like it that way. You talked of patriotism. We tend to be a little bit suspicious of patriotism up here. Not that we don't love our country. Well, actually, we probably wouldn't say that either. The love word. Though we do love it, but we don't feel comfortable saying it out loud. It's more of an unspoken thing. When it comes to national pride, about the farthest we can go is to say that we're happy to be here, more or less, to have made it this far. And we don't want to say or do anything that might upset the apple cart. Speaking of apples, you know that saying, as American as apple pie? We had a contest up here once to determine the Canadian equivalent. The winning entry to that unfinished phrase, as Canadian as a whatever, was as Canadian as possible under the circumstances. It's been suggested by one of my fellow broadcasters here at the CBC that you can have a pride of lions and a flock of birds, but if you were gathering up a collection of my fellow citizens, the proper collective noun would be an apology of Canadians. But don't get the feeling we're apologetic about that. We're kind of comfortable that way. We like the way it works out. No disrespect, but we would feel uncomfortable putting our hands on our hearts and pledging allegiance to a flag. Though make no mistake, we're proud of our flag. Plenty of us have died serving under it. It's just that we're nervous about patriotism, which we know can well be argued to be the motivating factor in the success that has come to be the American trademark, a brand of pride which can compel remarkable acts of self-sacrifice and devotion. But it is a brand of pride. And pride is one of the seven deadly sins and can lead to that blind, full-speed-ahead, my-country-right-or-wrong mentality, which doesn't seem to serve anyone that well. When it comes right down to it, we're kind of proud of our lack of pride. Oh, and our system of universal health care, we're proud of that for sure. And from up here, we just don't get why it's taking you so long to implement your own system, and why you still have the death penalty, and the whole thing with guns, which I have to tell you, worries us to no end. There is so much to talk about. We are so similar. Our tastes in music and food and all sorts of things. But there's all this other stuff below the surface that distinguishes us, and it's good to talk about it, good to get to know each other a little bit better each time we write. I send my best for your holiday weekend. Sincerely, your ice fishing pal, Stuart.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.